I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings,
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor and support the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, please check out the link below or go to our official website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and you'll see the link to become a Patreon sponsor yourself in the upper right-hand corner. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we have an interview with Mr. Paul Becker. Paul wrote a new book called Mike Mentzer and Me. It was just newly released about a week or two ago. And Paul is going to talk about his experience of training personally with Mike Mentzer before he passed away in 2001. And also his experience of using the high intensity training principle that Mike espoused. So we're going to have that interview coming up with Paul Becker in a second. After the interview, I'm going to read another article from one of Joe Weider's Muscle Builder magazines. And of course, this pertains to Mike Mentzer. It is from the March 1979 issue of Muscle Builder. And this was done right after Mike won the Mr. Universe contest in Acapulco in 1978. And of course, Mike scored that perfect 300 score at that contest. So in this issue of Muscle Builder, that was also the year that it was the first time that America won all three weight classes at the Mr. America. So Carlos Rodriguez won the lightweight class, Tom Platz won the middleweight class, and then Mike Mentzer won the heavyweight class. So Bill Reynolds did an article on each of these guys, and they talked about what their training was like to prepare for the contest. So I'm going to read that article about Mike. It's called The Universe Training. And again, it was written by Bill Reynolds. So I'll read that right after our interview with Paul Becker is up. All right. What else is going on, guys? It's been about 3 weeks since we've done a show on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. So we've got to talk about the Mr. Olympia contest, which took place on, when was that? November 3rd and 4th. And that was out in Orlando, Florida. So I was able to go to the show. I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to go to the show this year because I was not working the show like I was the last couple of years when it was in Orlando. But thanks to Dan Solomon, who is the president, I guess, of the Mr. Olympia, he puts on the whole contest. Jake Wood owns the Mr. Olympia, but Dan is in charge of promoting and putting on and going through the whole production. And Dan was able to get me some tickets. So I appreciate that, Dan. And I was able to see the pre-judging, which took place on Friday night. And then I went to the expo on Saturday, spent the whole day there, and I got to see the classic physique pre-judging out there. And then that evening, I went, of course, to the finals, which was the big event. And so we have a new Mr. Olympia again. It seems like every few years we've got a new Mr. Olympia winner. It's not like it was in the past, where guys like Lee Haney and Dorian Yates and Phil Heath and Ronnie Coleman would win year after year after year, 7-8 times in a row. Now we've got guys winning like 1, maybe 2 years, and then that's about it. In fact, let's see, if we go back to 2017, that was the last year Phil Heath won, and he won 7. And then in 2018, he was trying to win his 8th Mr. Olympia, and he would have tied the record with Lee Haney and with Ronnie Coleman. And he was beaten that year by Sean Roden. And then Sean only won 1 because he could not come back. If you remember, he had that rape charge against him from that one lady. And then they would not allow Sean to compete, which was really a travesty of justice, especially looking back at it now. And so in 2019, we had another new Mr. Olympia, and that was Brandon Curry. And then Brandon only won once because then in 2020, Big Ramy came in and he won. And he won 2 years in a row. He won 20 and 21. And then in last year in 2022, Hadi Chopin from Iran won the contest, and that was held out in Las Vegas. And Derek Lunsford was in second place. And Big Ramy dropped all the way down to 5th. So this year, Derek Lunsford won the contest, and it was another two-man battle between him and Hadi, and very, very close. In fact, I thought after the prejudging that Hadi was going to win because he was just harder from the front, which was also the case last year. Derek has an incredible back. Oh my God, his rear double bicep is probably the best in all of bodybuilding right now. Probably one of the best in the history of the sport. It's unbelievable. It's like a work of art. His lats are wide and super thick, and it's super detailed. And then he's got incredibly shredded glutes from top to bottom. And hamstrings are good. I mean, it's just an unbelievable pose. And I also felt like he won the rear lat spread as well. But Hadi looked better from the front. I thought Derek actually looked a little soft from the front. Like his ab pose was soft, and he didn't even really hit it. He just would hit he'd do an ab pose for like 1 second, and then he'd go into a vacuum pose. So I thought Hadi had enough to win again, although Derek, I thought, looked fantastic. And like I said, Derek won all the back shots for sure. But in the end, Derek is the new Mr. Olympia, and Hadi was in second place. Unfortunately, Nick Walker could not go in it. Nick was looking really good leading up to the show, and he was third place last year, and he made some amazing improvements, but he tore his hamstring about a week before the contest, a week or a week and a half, and he went down to the Mr. Olympia in Orlando. He lives in Las Vegas now, and he just decided by the time they got there, he could not compete. The whole leg was black and blue. He couldn't even move it. He actually was in a wheelchair all weekend. So he could not compete. So he'll be coming back next year. But it's interesting to think how Nick would have done, because he posted some pictures of a gym in Orlando where he was posing only days before the contest, before he decided to drop out. And he looked unbelievable. His waist was smaller. He was super tight, super hard. So, yeah, who knows how he would have done. But Samson Dauda, who was this year's Arnold Classic winner, he was in third place. And Samson, as expected, was huge. He was taller than Hadi and Derek, and really big and full and huge and great proportions. He's got incredible leg development, great upper body, but just was not ripped enough, not tight enough. So he was pretty much a solid third place. So he needs to come in harder. And then after that, it was between Andrew Jacked, who I really like his physique, and Brandon Curry, a former Mr. Olympia from 2018. So Brandon had a problem also. He was in the hospital. He was in the emergency room, I believe, the day before the prejudging on Thursday. And he had something with an ulcer or something. So they had to do some tests. They had to stick the tube down his throat. And he couldn't eat for many, many hours while he was in there. And I think he actually had to be fasted when he went in there before they did that test. He looked smaller, definitely smaller, undersized, but he was more cut more harder than last year. So he edged past Andrew Jacked and took fourth. And then Andrew was in fifth. Andrew really wasn't at his best. I think he actually still needs to get bigger because he's so tall. I'm not sure how tall he is. He's got to be at least 6'2". He towers over everybody else. And he's got very long arms, very long legs. He's got incredible ab development. Just really the best structure up there, and really has the potential to definitely be a Mr. Olympia winner, but he needs to be still bigger to match up with these other guys. So it was a very good contest, very well produced. There was some criticism of the contest because at Friday night, they do the men last, and they had like five other divisions before that. They had fitness and I believe wellness and figure, and they had the 212 division. There was like five divisions before they got to the men's prejudging. So by the time they got to the men's prejudging, it was about 10:30 at night. And there was complaints that all the guys looked off. Nobody was really in peak condition. And they think that's why they were blaming it on, you know, everybody who was watching the show was saying that these guys cannot really be in peak condition at 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night. So they used to always hold the Mr. Olympia on one day. They would have the prejudging at like 12 o'clock in the afternoon. And then at night at around 7 o'clock, they would have the finals. But now since they've added all these new divisions and they have to split it and they do half the divisions on Friday, half the divisions on Saturday, I think they don't feel like they're going to get big enough of an audience if they only hold those other divisions on Friday night. So they add the Mr. Olympia prejudging to all those classes on that Friday night. And then they pull in a huge house because everybody's waiting to see the Mr. Olympia. But they could move the Mr. Olympia up earlier in the night and do it first. But then I think they're afraid that they're going to lose their audience and everybody's going to leave. But that doesn't make any sense to me because they already paid for their tickets. So they already got their money and they paid for the pay-per-view. And I think if people travel all that way, I don't think they're just going to walk out of the auditorium. After the men are over, I'm sure they're going to stick around and watch the show. But that's my opinion. But we'll see if they change it next year, There was a lot of criticism of it this year, and there was a lot of criticism of it last year as well. And next year, it'll be going back to Las Vegas, and I believe it's going to be out there for a few years. I think they signed a multi-year deal out there, and it's a brand new hotel and a brand new theater. So that should be nice. I'm looking forward to seeing it in a theater again, because this was just at the convention center. So it was in this huge room. It was flat seating. So the stage was kind of on the same level as the seats. It wasn't in a theater where the seats are elevated above the stage, so you can, everybody in the auditorium can see it. So you kind of had to watch the video screens. You couldn't really see it, the action on the stage. And I had really good seats. I was sitting in the second section right in the middle. So I was right behind all the photographers and the judges in that section, but I still couldn't see the stage because all the photographers were standing up and I just couldn't see everybody. So I had to watch it on the screen, and they say it's different on the screen than it is in real life when you see it on the stage. So that's how it went. But anyways, it was a great show. It was great seeing a lot of people. I saw a lot of old friends from the bodybuilding community there, and I ran into a lot of fans of the show who came up to me and said they love listening to the podcast. So that was really great to hear. I don't get that kind of feedback. Of course, some people send me emails each week, but to get so many people coming up to me and wanting to tell me that was really, really gratifying after 6 years of doing this podcast. So we are going to keep going with this podcast and keep trying to get more interviews. I know we've had some trouble getting interviews lately, but I'll keep pushing and trying. There's a lot more people out there that I want to talk to that I haven't talked to yet. So we will try to get that going in the next few months of this year. And then, of course, going on to 2024. All right. What else is happening? John Little, who has been on the show, he used to be a writer for Muscle and Fitness magazine. John is working on another book on Mike Mentzer, which ties into the topic of today's show. So John has been asking me for some articles from these old muscle builders, and he's going to use those articles as information for his new book. So that'll be interesting. I did get some emails as well for this week, so I want to read those. All right. This one says, "Dear John, my name is Benny Harris. I'm in the delivery biz. I listen to your podcast to pass the time. I've always had an interest in bodybuilding. Therefore, your podcast has been a dream come true. I'm a fan of all the bodybuilding legends, especially Mike Mentzer, whom I feel changed my life." Wow. You'll love today's episode then, Benny. He says, "It's nice to learn more about what was actually like when bodybuilding was a sport, which consisted of actual men and women, as opposed to the steroid-induced sideshow freaks who have dominated the sport for the last 20-plus years. Like most things that once seemed to have had a degree of intellect in the midst, it now seems gaudy and infantile. Sorry, I'm old and jaded these days. Forgive me for the long intro. Two questions. I want to join the Patreon, but Google only seems to give links to the podcast, not your actual site. Could you send me a link?" Yes, I will do that, Benny. And then two, you're going to hate me for this. "Even though I found Stay Hungry to be a so-so movie, I found the premise interesting and I've wanted to read the book. Unfortunately, I can't seem to find a copy of the paperback that doesn't cost an arm and a leg. Is there any site which you could point me to where I may find a reasonably priced copy? I know that's a stupid question. I've just heard you reference Mr. Gaines's work numerous times and I've yearned to read it, but not on Google for many years. Have a wonderful week and thank you for your time." Yeah, I didn't realize how expensive that book was. After I got this email from Benny, I went on eBay and looked, and I think I only saw one copy. I think it was like $200 or $300. So I didn't realize it was that hard to get. But no, I really don't know where to get a copy of that. So I guess you'll just have to kind of look around for that. If anybody's got an extra copy of Stay Hungry and they want to let me know, I can email Benny and let him know. But the book was really well written, and it won a book award for Charles Gaines, and it was his first novel ever. And the movie was much, much different. I agree with you. I wasn't a big fan of the movie either, because I think Bob Rafelson really changed it. It was a drama, or even a tragedy, I guess you could say. And Bob Rafelson, if you heard our interview with Charles Gaines, his daughter just died right before he directed the movie. So he didn't want to do anything heavy. He didn't want to do like a tragedy. So he tried to make it into a comedy, and it really didn't work. It really wasn't that funny, and it was kind of quirky and kind of weird. Some critics liked it. I remember when I was growing up in Chicago, Gene Siskel liked Stay Hungry, And I think everybody liked Arnold's performance. You know, Arnold really did a great job. He won the Golden Globe Award for Best Acting Debut, and that was his first real movie. So, but yeah, if I hear anything, Benny, I will let you know about that. I got another email here. It says, John, I'm a little behind here, but I just watched your YouTube review of the 81 Mr. Olympia from last month, and I had to write in because I feel vindicated in my views on the placings. You're a renowned expert, and you attended the show. I did not, but I have pored over the photos in the mags, as we all did, studying them in detail, and I saw the placings exactly as you had them. I've always felt Tom Platt should have won that night. He outmuscled and outperformed everyone on stage. While his physique certainly wasn't as balanced as Danny, Roy, or Chris, the sheer amount of muscle was overwhelming. And Platt's had no weaknesses. He may have had a couple of body parts that were overdeveloped, but every square inch of him featured a heavy dose of dense ripped muscle. Danny and Roy were similar scenarios in that both were more muscular and defined than they had ever been before. Both had lost a bit of their signature fullness and mass in the process, but they both looked phenomenal. I would have put Roy in second. He presented an incredible physique that night, massive and shredded with no major weak points. He always had great lines to go with his mass. Great skin tone, too. I know a lot of old school pundits have Danny winning the show. He was incredibly shredded, and he was balanced with great symmetry, as always. I just felt he lost a bit too much of his signature mass to beat the other two. You could see it in comparisons with Franco's massive torso that Danny had lost a bit in that area. And not to pick on Danny, but I think he was lacking in the hamstrings and glutes. He was still bringing up the late 70s look where those body parts weren't as important. But it was a glaring, obvious weakness with Platts in the line. I thought it was close between Chris and Franco, but I would have to go with Chris in fourth place with his aesthetic lines, definition, posing, and polished professionalism. Franco, I would have put in fifth place. You can't say he was the best condition in the show when his legs were completely smooth. Definition, just like mass, needs to be uniform over the entire physique. Franco brought his signature massive and densely muscled torso with great abs and chest that draw your eye to him in the lineup. But the Mr. O goes way beyond that. When you break it all down, I think this is where he should have placed that night. Tom Platz presented a level of development and conditioning that night that was a good 15 years ahead of its time. That physique would have fit right into the lineup between Dorian, Lavroni, and Sean Ray at the 96-0. Like it or not, he showed everyone the future of bodybuilding and where it was headed that night. Ron Dunn. Well, Ron, I can't agree with you more. I absolutely agree with all your points. I thought Platz had it as well. I thought he just had everything that night. He was super massive. Like you said, his legs, of course, were bigger than his upper body, but his upper body was huge. And he just had everything going. You know, I've said this before on other podcasts. Every so often, you'll see a bodybuilder who just everything comes together on one night, on one contest. And sometimes it'll never happen again for them. That's the only time where everything just the stars line up and it's just perfect. And that's how I thought Tom Platz was that night. I thought everything lined up for him. His size, his definition, his charisma, his color, his attitude on stage, everything. It was just perfect. He was, in my opinion, Mr. Olympia that night. And his legs were gigantic, and they were bigger than they'd ever been. But his upper body was just keeping tabs with it. I thought it wasn't like two totally different physiques. He had a great back. Even his arms were bigger. If you look at like his side tricep pose, his triceps looked good. His chest was always big. His chest looked huge, and he had great abdominals. So I just thought he had it all. And I agree with you about Danny and Roy, too. I thought, yeah, you're right. They both were more ripped than ever, especially Danny. And even Roy was more ripped than he'd ever been. But they did lose a little bit of fullness, both of them. The thing I thought put Roy ahead of Danny was his aggressiveness on stage. I'd never seen him aggressive like that. He always was kind of laid back. Because I had seen him compete at the 1977 Mr. International when he lost to Makawe. And then I saw him in 78 and 79 at the Mr. Olympia. So he'd never been that aggressive before. And his legs were ripped. I remember he had that sartorius muscle in his thighs. And he kept putting that next to Franco's thighs when they were standing in the lineup together because they were standing right next to each other. So, yeah, I would have put him in second for those reasons. And Danny absolutely looked amazing. I mean, especially when you look at pictures of him today, he still looks incredible. But there's a difference between looking at pictures when he's posing by himself and then seeing him in the lineup with Tom and Roy and Franco and all those guys. And he, you know, he's obviously short. It's probably like 5'2", 5'3". But he just didn't come across as overwhelming like Platts did. I mean, Platts really projected. And that's the difference between seeing a picture in a contest and seeing the contest in person. You're not seeing that in a picture, especially when you're not seeing him next to those other guys. And, you know, Danny is smaller. He's a little bit more narrow, I guess, than the other guys. When you look at a picture of him by himself, he looks perfect. But that wasn't the contest. He was up on stage with these other guys. So that's why I would have him in third, too. And I think most people who weren't there and only see pictures of the contest, that's why they have Danny in first. And then I also would have had Chris ahead of Franco, just because, number one, Franco's big weakness with the legs. You can't have him beat anybody just because of that weakness, no matter how good his upper body looked. And Chris was very professional. I thought Chris looked better the year before in 1980. He seemed thicker in 1980. He was smaller in 1981. And he just didn't come across as good as those first three. But it's weird, too. You know, when we talked to Jerry in that video that you mentioned, we did mention the one thing that was really weird was that Tom and Danny and Roy, who everybody agrees should have been in the top three, they had never even been in the top five before at the Mr. Olympia. The year before, Danny was 10th, Tom was 9th, and Roy was, I believe, 7th. He was tied with Roger Walker for 6th. They had a special pose down between the two of them, and then he got 7th place, and Roger was 6th because Roger was in the pose down with the top six. So to take three guys that had never even made the top five before and put them first, second, and third, I think the judges, they weren't going for that. That's why they stuck with Franco and Dickerson, and they gave them the high scores. Franco really did look amazing, though, at that contest. But you're right. You make a good point that you can't say he had the best conditioning or he was the hardest guy up there when his legs had no conditioning at all. That's a good point. I never really thought of that, but that's an excellent point. All right. So that is all we got for our opening, guys. Thank you for your emails. If anybody out there wants to send me any emails, please send them to naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I will read them on the air. All right, let's get to our interview with Mr. Paul Becker. Paul just wrote a new book called Mike Mentzer and Me, and it is now available. So here's our interview with Paul. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have a special guest with us this week. His name is Mr. Paul Becker, and he just wrote a new book called Mike Mentzer and Me, My Heavy-Duty Journal of High-Intensity Training, The Logical Approach to Bodybuilding. How you doing, Paul?
Doing good. Glad to be here.
So tell me about how you decided to do this book. You were actually training with Mike Mentzer for a while, right?
Yeah, I mean, I started bodybuilding in 78. I think you were two before. And Mike Mentzer was all the way in. And I went and bought his book. I got it in 79. And I started doing that type of training.
Okay.
And I bought his book, of course, read all his articles and everything. And then when I moved to California, you know, he was training people. So I actually went and met with him and got personally trained by him.
Okay.
And got to sit and talk. Questions and, you know, things like that.
And what year was that you were starting to actually train with Mike?
In 99.
99, okay. How old were you then, Paul?
I would have been almost 37. I think I was 36, almost 37.
Okay, cool. So when you were younger and you admired Mike, did you follow his principles then when you were younger and starting bodybuilding in 1978?
Well, you know, it's interesting because my original workout in doing nothing was pretty much just, I just did one set. I just had a handful of exercises that I knew, things mm-hmm. like, I didn't have a bench originally, but I had a bar set. So I did dips and press overhead and rows and curls. And I just did one set as hard as I could and did the next exercise. And that's how I worked out originally. Just I figured that's how you should do it. And the only problem is I was doing it every day.
Oh, okay.
So then eventually I did. So then when I started reading all the Arnold and et cetera, then I was like, oh, okay, you got to do more than what I've been doing. But then when I finally got Mike's book, I was like, yes, this is the way I like to train anyway, hard and fast. And so, yeah, I've been pretty much doing some form of high intensity training since 79. I mean, I've occasionally programs and a little bit higher volume, but mostly that's the way I like to train.
And you got good results from that?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not Mr. Olympia, but you know, I've competed successfully at the national state level, and then competed at the national level once, the Masters USA last year. Mm-hmm. And I did okay. And, you know, I mean, I'm not taking what those guys are taking, but it was, I didn't look out of place, and it was a great experience to be there.
Okay. So what was it like meeting Mike Mentzer for the first time in 1999?
You know, it was like one of those things of, you know, if you met Mickey Mantle or something, you know, it's like mm-hmm. he was this guy who, hearing about for years and years and years, and I'm going to meet him and he's going to train me. And so it was exciting for me. And he was a nice guy. And, you know, a lot of people have negative things to say about him, but it seems like he was at a good point in his life when he met me. And he, you know, he didn't seem weird or strange or anything. And
yeah.
But it was really good to be able to like, okay, so what is, you know, what kind of form does Mike have for your exercise? What's the rep speed? What kind of failure is he talking about? So all those things. And, you know, he would take through work and then he would take me outside and we'd sit and talk for a while. And that was really enjoyable, too, because you get to pick his brain and just get to know him as a person.
Was that before the workout or after?
No, after. He'd meet him, and then after the workout, we'd go outside and sit outside.
Okay.
And talk. He would talk and we would talk.
Yeah. So when you started training with him, did he ask you like what your goals are and how much experience you had and things like that?
I remember him putting his finger, he checking my wrist size.
Oh, okay.
And I said, oh, I got a small frame. And he said, no, it's not that small. You should see how small Robbie Robinson's wrist is.
Yeah.
And but he, you know, he also commented on that I had it built. And he would like to work with me for a few months, which was what I was thinking, too, at the time. It's like, man, after that, you know, that first workout, I'd be like, what would it be like to work out with him for months? Which didn't happen because he was doing seminars. He was going out of town to do seminars, and okay. I ended up moving out anyway. But I definitely had a few workouts with him, which was, you know, I learned a lot and got to see, you know, meet the man and pick his brain.
Okay. So when you did your workouts, did he tell you like what you were going to do, or did you say, well, this is the workout that I do, and then you did that workout? I mean, was it his idea or your idea for the workout?
I mean, I did show him my work, I brought my training journal and I showed him what I currently was. But no, he chose what we were going to do.
Okay.
Which, if you've read his Heavy Duty 2, Mind and Body, that's the workout he put me through.
Okay.
The first workout we did was legs. And then the next workout we did was chest and back.
Okay.
But he had like chest and back, legs. And then your next workout was legs again. And then the next workout was shoulders and arms.
Oh, okay.
And then repeat.
And how many days in between workouts?
You know, in the book, he suggested like 3 days off. But, you know, I remember telling him, like, oh, I just did back a couple of days ago. And he was like, oh, it'll be fine. So, you know, I think that he wasn't as stuck on it as some think.
Yeah.
Like one of the reasons I even wrote the book was, first of all, I start seeing his books, his original books, people asking hundreds of dollars, $400 for a copy of like Duty One.
Really? Wow.
Et cetera. Yeah, look on eBay and Amazon and see if you could find his book. People were asking insane prices for it.
Wow, no kidding.
Because they're out of print. They're out of print.
Yeah.
Most people don't want to sell them if they have them.
Yeah.
So, and then there was another thing where I saw a guy who made a video about trying the routine. He just without really understanding the theory of it, just followed it blind. Just, okay, I'm going to work. I'm going to do this chest and back. Then I'm going to rest 3 days. Then I'm going to do legs. Then I'm going to rest 3 days off. You know, and he didn't get good results. And that's what he reported. And I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't expect you to.
So why wouldn't a guy like that get good results? Because what did Mike do differently then?
Well, Mike even said, if you listen to his interviews and seminars, he even talked about genetic differences, like there's giants, there's midgets, there's albino, super dog skin people, and not, you know, so there's the same thing with exercise tolerance and recovery ability.
Okay.
You can't just blindly follow that routine. It could be too little for you, too much rest.
Okay.
You've already grown and already started to atrophy. It could be too much if you're like a midget of recovery ability or an albino of it, you know.
Yeah.
It could be too much because Mike had one workout where you do three sets and rest a week. That was his, you know, like you do a squat and a dip and a pull down with your palms up, pull down, and that was the whole workout, which covers the whole body.
Yeah.
And you use that for guys who were like really super hard gainers. So Mike would, if he worked personally with people in the gym or a phone client, he might start them at a certain level, but he would adjust it based on what was going on with them, because not everybody's the same.
Okay. So did he do that with you then, Paul, when you started training with him? How did he learn like what your recovery was?
Well, we didn't train long enough to adjust, but he had already, just the fact that he said, you know, because I was kind of thinking along the lines like, don't I need all this rest? And you know, I told him back a few days ago, he's like, it'll be fine. You know, I guess he was just judging it on my development and you know, what we did on the first workout. But if we were worked longer, I think he would have known me a little bit better.
Yeah.
I mean, I did continue to follow. He wrote down, you know, he wrote down a workout for me, you know, and I continued to follow for a while, and I adapted myself, because he eventually passed on anyway. He passed on once.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't much longer. I had already moved. I moved to Oregon from California. Yeah. That was shocking to hear that he had passed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Did you see the DVD that he made, the workout DVD he made right before he died?
No, no.
Okay. Because he made a workout DVD right before he died. Him and his brother and Marcus Reinhardt were in it.
Yeah.
And I was shocked. He looked 20 years older.
Really?
The time that I think. What health problems did he have or whatever? And I heard he had some heart attacks and he fell down some steps and there was some stuff. But wow. It was strange.
So just in 1 year, you saw a huge difference in his... And how he looked.
I was with him in the summer 99, and he died June 10th, I believe, 2021. So 2 years.
Yeah.
He looked like he aged. Because when I met him, he was 47, and he looked about that age.
Yeah.
But in the video, he's 49, and he looks like 70. It's strange. Oh, wow.
No kidding. Wow, that's crazy.
But he had a lot of health issues, sadly.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a lot of health issues in the Mensah family.
Yeah.
Like even his parents died fairly young.
His dad did, yeah. Right.
I just read an old interview where he mentioned that there was some kind of genetic clotting issue in his family.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people want to run to the drugs, steroids, whatever killed him, but his parents and his certainly weren't taking those.
Yeah, usually with the heart attacks, it's always genetic, or a lot of times it's genetic. So tell me a little bit about like your workouts with him. For example, like what did you guys do for legs?
Legs, he had me do leg extension.
Okay.
To failure. Immediately, I believe we were on the machine where you, the Nautilus machine where it's built in. The leg extension's there and the leg press is there.
Right.
So right after the leg extension was when you start the leg press and you do that to failure.
Okay.
I was all for thighs.
Then
we did calves, just one set of standing calves.
Okay.
And then he doesn't usually have you do it, but he did have me do a leg curl because he wanted to show me the static contraction.
Okay.
So basically had me hold, put a pretty heavy weight on it and help me into the fully contracted position.
Okay.
And I held that there as good, and then he had me lower that really, really slow.
Okay.
That was good for legs.
So when you did the leg extension, leg press, did he have you? I mean, obviously he trains to failure. So did you do any warm ups or did you just go right to that one set?
Yeah, he had me warm up a little bit on the leg press.
Okay. But, so you did like a little warm up on the extension and the leg press.
He'd take maybe 50% of the weight and have, but it was only, I don't know, do four reps and then 75% of the weight and do like 3-4 reps. But then he was having me do reps that were like 4 seconds up and 4 seconds down.
Even on the warm up?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, it's still, you know, the warm ups, you know, it's not as short as if you did fast reps as though.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I understand. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You know, he felt that was sufficient warm up. And then we ride into the leg extension, leg press.
So then you do the one set and it's all out to failure. So did he do any like force reps or negatives or were they just positive failure?
Just a positive failure. Okay. He had, at that point in his life, you know, he knew that most people, it was overkill for like, you know, because back when Ray and him trained in the 70s, they did positive failure, then force reps, then
negative reps.
You know, they used, you know, and he found that for most people, that's a bit overkill.
Okay.
It's more than what they need.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. He just took me to positive failure, which is still pretty hard.
You know? Yeah.
Especially on the press after you're done with that leg extension. It's pretty hard.
Yeah. Were you sore from that, Paul? Like after a couple days after?
You know, I was pretty conditioned, so I didn't get super, a little bit, not super sore. I had already been used to, you know, it wasn't like super different than what I had been doing in the gym anyway, except I didn't always do the pre-exhaust.
Okay.
But yeah, I got sore, and I definitely felt it right after the workout. My legs definitely felt worked.
Yeah.
For sure.
Okay. And then how many days would you rest your legs before you went back and did them again?
Well, you know, what he had me do, what he wrote down for me was you do, because he basically considered chest and back and upper body workout.
Okay.
So then let's start with chest and back. Then you rest 3 days and you do legs. Then you rest 3 days and then you do shoulders and arms, which he considered an upper body workout.
Okay.
And then you wait another 3 days and did legs again. So.
Oh, okay.
That ends up about a week for legs.
Okay. All right.
Like legs once a week-ish, six to seven, whatever it would be.
Okay. Gotcha. And what would you do for chest and back?
Chest and back, he had me do a pec deck, superset, you know, pre-exhaust superset with incline press. The income plus he had you do like your hands close and your elbows was what you had wide.
Oh, hands close. That was, wide.
Yeah. Yeah. He felt it's the elbows that have to, I mean, not super close, but you know how most people do an incline or a bench press. They have a wide grip. He felt that the grip was probably about shoulder width, but then the elbows were wide, you know, you kept your elbows flared out wide.
Okay, that's interesting.
And then
that was a barbell. That was a barbell thrust, not a machine.
No, he did it. He did it on a machine.
Okay.
It was, I don't know what machine that is, but it was, you know, it was not a hammer, but more like it looked more like an old school universal type device, which had the weight stack and the handles.
Oh, okay.
But but it was specifically an incline press.
And you do the pec deck and then go right to that.
Yeah, with no rest, no rest in between. And that was pretty much what he had me do for chest. And then for the back, he had me do palms up, pull downs.
Mm-hmm.
And on things like pec deck, like I said, 4 seconds. But on things like pec deck and pull downs where there was a where there's resistance in the contracted position, he would have me hold that count of two. So we'll say you hold down. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, hold, you know, hold 1,000, 2,000, and then back up the 4.
Okay.
So the form was really strict and, you know, kept the tension on the muscle throughout.
Gotcha. Okay.
And he chose a weight. He just kind of chose a weight that I would be able to do on pull down. And the first rep was hard. And I was like, I said to him, I says, Mike, I think this is too heavy. He said, no, you'll be fine. You'll do 6-8. And he got me to do 6-8 reps. So I was like, wow, that's pretty, you know, if I was on my own, training on my, probably would have stopped and lowered the weight. But
You
know, having somebody like that to push you was pretty cool.
Okay. So it was a heavy weight. It was really, really heavy.
Yeah.
Challenging. Yeah.
It felt hard. Like that first rep felt hard, but somehow or another he had about 6-8, even in that strict, slow style. So.
Yeah. So what were you doing? You were doing the pull down underneath, and what were you supersetting that with?
No, there wasn't a superset.
Oh, there wasn't a superset. Okay.
At one point, he was having people do pullover, pull down, like a Nautilus pull.
Yeah, that would be like an isolation and a condom.
Yeah, but at this point, he almost felt like that was too much for most people. So he just had me do the.
So your chest back workout was really 3 exercises then total.
Well, yeah. And then afterwards, he had me do a set of deadlifts.
Oh, really? Deadlifts. Okay.
And he felt, you know, he felt like that was one of the best overall body exercises. You know?
Okay. So how would you do that? Like a regular deadlift off the floor? Huh?
Yeah, regular deadlift with the, I forget what, you know, the grip where one hand's forward, one hand's back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, of course, that same kind of strict style and everything.
Yeah. And then how many reps would you do on that? Like 6-8? Pretty heavy?
I believe 5-8 reps was what he recommended for the deadlift.
Okay. All right. So
for most upper body exercises, he was recommending 6-10. But if you would do pec deck, that would be 6-10. But then the incline press, he said 2-4. And later on, I thought about that, and I was like, he was trying to be like, he was still trying to make you use the weight you would usually use for an incline press, not lower it. So that's why you could only eke out about 2-4 on it. And then for lower body exercises, he like thighs, it was kind of like 8-15 or something like that. But then for calves, it was like 12-20 reps is what he
recommended. Oh, okay. So you said incline press, he would have you do a weight you could only do 2-4 reps?
Yeah.
Wow, that's wild.
I never understood that, but I recently thought about it, and I said, you know, he was just because a lot of people, if they do a pre-exhaust, they'll lower the weight that they use. Okay. Pre-exhaust for bench press, you lower the weight so you can do like whatever 8-10 reps with the bench press, even after a pec deck or a fly. But I think Mike was just like, no, you're going to use the same damn weight you use, and you're just going to do a few less reps is all.
Oh, okay. So you train with him for a month. So would he use the same weight each week or each, like if he did, the next time you did chest and back, would he use the same weight and then just try to get you to do more reps?
That would depend on what your performance was. Like if you were at your top, like if, you know, if you had done, let's say you did 10 reps on the pec deck and four or more on the incline press, then the weight's up.
Then it would raise the weight.
Didn't quite. Let's say you only made 2 reps on the incline press. You know, he would try to get you to do more reps rather than more
Okay.
Weight.
Okay. Okay. That's interesting. So you only worked with him basically for a month then, and then he was busy doing his seminars and stuff.
Yeah. I was getting ready to move. I think he did, I don't know if you've ever seen, he did a seminar in Canada, and I think that he went out to go do that, and it just didn't work out, but we could get more workouts in. And I was stupid because I put that off. I used to call him up, and I was living in Hollywood, and he was in Santa Monica, and he'd go, come on down. Okay, we'll do that one day, you know, and then my wife tells me, hey, you know, I got a job offer in Oregon. I better go do some things that I'm not going to have a chance to do once I move.
Yeah.
So, you know, I called him up and made the appointment. Workouts in with the man.
So after a month of training with him consistently, Paul, what did you notice as far as the changes in your physique?
I got stronger in those particular lifts. At first, everything seemed to be working, but I kept that up after I moved too.
Yeah.
And completely honest, it was too much rest for me. I feel like I was, the truth is that you're training chest twice a month.
Yeah.
And the truth is, now Mike used to ask people, he asked everybody, he said that, have you ever noticed if you come back from a layoff, even 2 to 3 weeks, you're stronger?
Yeah.
What's your answer to that?
Yeah, if you're overtrained, yeah.
Yeah. But for me, it's like, Nope, I'm not stronger. I might be a little bit weaker. I might be the same or a little bit weaker. 2 to 3 weeks, yeah.
That's a long layoff, yeah.
I think that I had already recovered and was going downhill, you know, because, you know, it's like when you stimulate a muscle.
Backwards, yeah.
Yeah, that stimulate a muscle, you get an up swoop, and if enough time goes by, it starts going down again. So
Right. Okay.
And I just started adjusting things for what worked for me better.
Okay. So you adjusted the routine then and gave yourself less rest days.
Yeah. Because it's just for my body, like I said, I don't, you know, I 2 to 3 weeks, I'm weaker. I might be able to do the same weight, but I have to do a few less reps and then work my way back up if I take that much time off.
I agree.
So yeah, I just did what works best for me. That's kind of what the book's about. It's like my own journey on, because I tried every routine Mike ever put out. That original routine that he had in the first book I got in 79 was a 4-day-a-week routine.
Yeah.
You train half your body Monday and Tuesdays, and the other half of your body on Thursdays and Fridays.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for years and eventually had to switch that to an every other day because it was getting to be too much.
Mm.
So the book covered my whole journey of like starting at 17 and the different routines I went through and what I'm, and even up to what I do these days.
Oh, okay.
And just give people like, well, how do you decide what's right for you? And it's gonna take some trial and error and some observation and experimentation.
Yeah,
somebody can give you, okay, we'll try this, but you're still gonna have to see how your own body responds to any training.
Yeah. So when Mike first came out as a bodybuilder, and then he came out with this revolutionary training program where it was less sets and, less exercises. I remember one of the criticisms he was getting from guys like Arnold was they were saying that he wasn't doing enough exercises to fully develop the body. If he's only doing one or two exercises for a big body part like back, then he's not going to be able to get the upper back, the lower lats, the middle back. So how do you feel about that criticism?
I think he was doing more. I think he would do some type of pullover and
the Nautilus pullover. He did that a lot.
And then a row, but he would also work his traps, which are part of your back, and sometimes work his spinal erectors with. So now he was definitely doing less than the 70s guys were doing.
Sure, yeah.
And but you know, for myself, like Mike had everybody do later, you know, later, his later suggestions with people just do a pec deck or a fly and an incline press, and that's it for your chest.
Yeah.
And for me, I don't think it's enough.
Yeah.
You know, I currently do like a dumbbell bench, an incline dumbbell bench, a dip, and then a fly or a pec deck.
Or
that seems to handle all the areas of the chest. Cause I find if I don't do dips, my lower pecs aren't there really.
Right, right.
So
how do you do that? Do you do like what Mike suggested, like a couple warm up sets, and then you do the one all out set? You're still doing that that structure?
Yeah.
Okay. But you just added more
exercise. Just one work set per exercise.
Okay.
And that seems to work for me.
And then how are you progressing? Are you judging it by how many reps you're getting? And then when you get a certain number of reps, do you go up in weight, or how do you do that?
Yeah, pretty much the same.
Okay.
If I did 10 or better reps, there's some exercises I'll do a little more reps with, and like the pec deck, I'll do a little more reps than let's say the dumbbell press, you know, dumbbell bench. Like I might go up on the dumbbell bench if I hit 10 reps. On the pec deck, it might be over 12 or something.
Oh, okay. Okay. Now, you said you were a natural bodybuilder, Paul. Do you feel that this training is better for someone who's natural than it would be for someone who's enhanced?
I don't really know how to judge it because I've never been on, right? So,
yeah.
But I do think, you know, I'm told that, you know, steroids can, you know, you can do more work more often. And, you know,
yeah,
look, if you could do that, you would probably make better progress. Like if you could train, you know, more often and with more sets, you and still recover and grow and not get exhausted and catch a cold or whatever happens, you know, things that happen when you get overtrained, I think you do better. But so just from what I understand, I think it's better. But even though I'm very much into high intensity training, I also know it there's more than one way to skin a cat.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you can make progress with doing higher volume or you know, more pump sets and things like that. And I think that also has to do with what you know, your own personality type. A more mm-hmm. laid back guy might be like, you know, I just like taking it a little easier, but doing more sets and getting a better pump.
Okay.
And,
yeah.
But for me, it's boring. I've done it. You know, it's like, it's kind of boring. Oh, I got three more sets of this exercise. So I kind of like to get in there, work hard, and go do something else.
Is it hard to get psyched up to knowing that every workout you have to go to all out failure? Do you have certain days where you're like, oh, I just, you know, I had a bad day. I didn't get enough sleep. I don't feel like going all out, you know, to complete failure.
Yeah. I mean, look, the thing is, if you're doing this as a lifestyle.
Yeah.
You're not necessarily, every workout isn't going to be your best workout ever. It's just, you know, it's like, so yeah, there's some days I might not even push myself that hard. Okay. I got what I got last time.
Yeah. Yeah.
That next workout, if I feel, if I'm more energetic or more into it, I'll do better.
Yeah.
So I basically, there is a certain amount of, you know, the body's not a machine. It's got ups and downs. So I go with it because it's like, it's not, there isn't an emergency, right? I mean, mm-hmm. when I'm training for a contest, of course I'm more motivated, but just on every day I have some up days and some down days, but in general, the trend is up.
Yeah. So I noticed in the book, one of your chapters is heavy duty nutrition and diet. What kind of philosophy did Mike have in regards to nutrition that was different from the regular bodybuilding nutrition?
Well, you know, the funny thing is Mike was opposite on everything. Yeah. Back in the day, everything was high volume.
Yeah.
And low carb, high fat, high protein diet.
Right.
Mike, like, no, low volume, high intensity training, high carbohydrate, low fat, moderate protein diet.
Right.
He was opposite everybody.
Right.
But basically what he was suggesting was, back in the day, we learned this in school, they didn't have the pyramid back then. They had the four food groups.
Yeah, yeah.
Back when we were kids, right, in school. And that's what he said. Look, this is what, you know, nutritional scientists recommend. It's a balanced diet. You get your fruits and vegetables and your grains and cereals and your dairy product and your meat and poultry and eggs and things like that. And you, mm-hmm. you know, you have the recommended serving. So it's all balanced. But if you want to gain weight, you have to have a calorie surplus. And if you want to lose weight and fat, you have a deficit of calories.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, he always said that calories are calories, but he also acknowledged that, you know, there are hormonal issues. Like if you take in a bunch of sugar, you do get insulin spikes and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But in general, his philosophy on diet was fairly simple. And let's be honest, Mike had great genetics.
Yeah.
And I said it didn't matter what Mike ate. Mike could eat, you know, white bread and turn it into muscle.
Yeah.
So it's just like training. The basics are there. You still want to have a fairly balanced diet and calories, you know, do count. But there's still going to be variations. Like I couldn't eat a 60% carbohydrate diet and get ripped.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially as you get older.
When I train for a contest, I have adequate protein, low fat, and moderate carbs.
Okay.
And that's what works for me.
Yeah. 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 Especially as you get older, it changes. So.
Yeah.
The book is released. You just released it about a week ago, you said, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
A week, Friday, and like 2 days. Yeah. About 8 days or whatever it's been. Yeah.
And what's your website, Paul?
Trulyhuge.com.
Trulyhuge.com. Okay. And you can also get it on Amazon, you said, as well, right?
Yeah. So okay. It's currently listed. It's currently for sale on my website and then Amazon and eBay.
Okay.
Seem to have it up on BarnesandNoble.com.
Okay, cool. Anything else you want to mention about the book? I tried to cover some of what was in your table of contents here, but is there anything else that stands out to you when you wrote the book?
I think it just will. It'll give a good overview of Mike's training, you know, Mike's training and philosophy, and I think also and my journey over the last 45 years, and I think people will find some of it entertaining.
Yeah,
and will also, you know, see themselves in a lot of my stories, and also learn like how to apply this to themselves.
Yeah. 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 I know Mike is still, you know, he's been dead for what, over 20 years now. Yeah. And he's still very, very popular. And I know anytime I do a show about him or we talk about him, like we've had John Little, who's an author, and he was a good friend of Mike. We've had him on the show a few times. It always gets a lot of views because people are really still interested in Mike, I think, himself, and also in his training philosophy.
Yeah. You know, it's like Mike had said in an interview once that he thought that Joe Weider was doing the public a disservice by saying they had to train 6 days a week for hours a day.
Yeah.
Because he runs like, yeah, I'd like to work out, but who's got that time?
Right.
You know, but
it wasn't good for the average person.
Yeah. The average person is more than willing to work out, let's say 3-4 days a week for 35 minutes. They have time for that.
Yeah.
And you can get good results from doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. When I got into bodybuilding, it was around 1976, 77. So that's when Mike was kind of just coming on the scene. And I remember everybody, you know, like when I started going to a gym, everybody was training 6 days a week, everybody. And then I remember we all were reading the magazines because everybody read the magazines back then. And we were hearing, you know, what we were all reading about Mike's way of training. And we all did. I think everybody pretty much across the board changed their philosophy a little bit, you know. Maybe they weren't doing one set, an exercise like Mike was. But I think everybody cut back. You know, if we were training 6 days a week, we probably went to 4 days a week or at least 3 days on, 1 day off or something. We were taking into consideration the recuperation of the muscles and how the muscles grow when they're resting and cutting back on that volume and then increasing the intensity. So I think Mike really did change the whole philosophy of training and really did change the sport by himself. Absolutely. You know? Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, I look at routines now and they're more like, because Mike back then wasn't always doing one set. He would do two to three sets sometimes per exercise. But still, funny story is when I was working out in the gym in 79, and after my workout, I just sat and talked with the manager.
Okay.
He says to me, "You know who I think has this all figured out? Mike Mentzer." And I go, "How come? You know, why do you say it?" And he says, "Because everybody else is doing 20 sets per body part. Here's this guy doing 3 to 5 sets per body part, and he's growing so fast."
Yeah.
And he took a magazine he had on his desk and rips out the order form for Mike's book and hands it to me. So I was like, "I'll read it." You know,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
it. But yeah, when I look at programs, like I remember a bunch of the programs like Bill Phillips used to recommend. It's like, This is so reminiscent of what Mike was doing in the 70s, 4 days a week, you know.
Yeah.
You know, maybe 3 to 5 sets of body part. You know, and it's more common now than doing because Arnold would and those guys at times would be doing with their double split and everything, they were training each body part 3 times a week.
Yeah.
And it was just, he talked about up to four or five hours a day in the gym because they do the morning work, evening workout.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it seems like what Mike was suggesting then is almost common. And let's be honest, Dorian Yates had a lot to do with that, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dorian had a high intensity training program. It wasn't. You know, as low as what Mike was later suggesting, but Dorian did what worked for him.
Yeah.
But it was still more of a low volume, high intensity approach than what Arnold and those guys were doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I see these younger kids on social media and stuff, and I don't think they really understand how training works. And I don't know where they're getting their information, maybe some YouTube channel or something. And they think that you have to do like a certain amount of volume. You have to do a lot of sets. And I'll even see a lot of them at the gym and they're not training hard, but they're just putting in the sets. And like sometimes if someone's on a bench and I'll say, "How many sets you got left?" They'll say, "I just started." Like they've got a long way to go. You know, they're just doing so many sets and they feel like you have to put in all these sets in order to make progress. I don't think they understand the idea of intensity and recuperation that the muscle can only handle so much, you know?
Exactly. Well, it's interesting because I when I was training for the Masters USA, I trained in the local gym. Usually I train in my home gym. But
okay.
It was so hot. It's a garage gym and it was so hot that summer. I decided, let me train in the local gym. And I saw some guys, and, you know, I'd be in and out of there in 30, 40 minutes. And those guys were in there, you know, and they'd still be training the same body part when I was done with, you know, like 2 or 3 body parts. They'd still be, I don't know how long they went. And then I was in the grocery store the other day and I saw both those guys. And I was like, they look exactly the same as they did a year ago. They've done all this work and their physiques are not improved.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, the whole idea of intensity and how hard you really have to train in order to force the muscle to grow, I think a lot of people still don't understand that even after all these years.
Exactly. I mean, look, that's a basic, because, like, I think that even Arnold, they would at least do that last set of an exercise pretty damn hard.
Yeah.
but they did a lot of work up to it, you know, a lot of pyramiding up to that.
Yeah. Super yeah.
And look, those guys, you know, look, Arnold had the best genetics ever. He was on steroids. His job was training.
Yeah.
So, you know, all those things that he could get away with, the volume he did. But, you know, when you talk, Rick Drayson, he said in the offseason they weren't doing all that.
Right, you right.
Know, 4 days a week.
Yeah.
A lot less. So, you know, it wasn't, that was pre-contest.
Yeah,
and we,
yeah.
We all thought that's what we had to do to get the original size, right?
Yeah, yeah, I made that mistake. I made that mistake too.
It was attractive because everybody wants to be Arnold,
right? Exactly.
Even now, 50 years later, like this is going to be 50 years since the 1974 Mr. Olympia.
Yeah,
I look at the pictures and I say nobody looks like that today.
I know.
You know, it's like they got bigger. Maybe they got bigger thighs, bigger backs, but their waists are. Their waists are much bigger.
Yeah.
But even I saw an interview with Ronnie Coleman that said, look at Arnold's pecs. Nobody's had pecs.
That's before. True.
And the bicep, he was just outstanding. Him and Sergio still.
Yeah, I agree.
Now it is like, what kind of genetics do these guys have? It's amazing.
Yeah. And they're both around at the same time too. That's really wild.
Yeah. I got to meet Sergio once. He's a super nice guy. Of course, he wasn't, you know, this was 2004. He didn't look like anything, but.
Yeah, yeah.
In his day, unbelievable. Oh,
unbelievable, the myth. Yeah. All right, Paul. Well, listen, best of luck to you with your new book. It's called Mike Mentzer and Me. And it, as Paul said, it's available now on Amazon. And on, what's your website again, Paul?
Trulyhuge.com.
Trulyhuge.com. That's easy to remember. Okay. All right, Paul. Well, we wish you the best of luck with the book, and I'll put the links below on this interview so people can click there and buy it. I hope it does really well.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's an honor to be on your show. I watch it all the time.
Oh, great. Thank you. All right, Paul. Well, best of luck to you, and take care.
Yep. Thanks again.
All right, Paul. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to Paul Becker for coming on the show and talking about his new book. And I will have the links to where you can get that book below. So just check that out on the links below. I also want to thank all our Patreon donors for supporting the show every week. I appreciate you guys. I could not do the show without you. So if you're interested in becoming a Patreon donor, again, just go to our website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the link to becoming a Patreon donor. Or I also have the link below in the links section below. All right. Before I let you guys go, I'm going to read this article, and this comes from the March 1979 issue of Joe Weider's Muscle Builder and Power magazine. And as I mentioned before in the opening, this was right after the 1978 Mr. Universe contest, which is covered in this magazine. And this was the first time ever that the American team won all three divisions. Carlos Rodriguez won the lightweight class, Tom Platz won the middleweight class, and Mike Mentzer won the heavyweight class. So there was a lot of coverage of Mike in this magazine. They had another separate article called The Training Strategies of Mike Mentzer. They had the full Mr. Universe report in here. But then they have another article on him. And like I said, they had three different articles. Bill Reynolds did them all. And they're basically called a special Mr. Universe training report, how the three Mr. Universe winners did it. Exercises, routines, diets, and everything. So I've never read this one about Mike. So I wanted to read it. So it says, Mike Mentzer, heavyweight, by Bill Reynolds. Heavy duty Mike finds third time a charm in winning the world title, but he's still far from satisfied. One would think that winning a world championship after two disappointing tries and making the first perfect 300 score in the worlds would make Mike Mentzer deliriously happy. Such was not the case. To me, it's a relief to win, Mike recently told me. I wasn't really that ecstatic about winning, however, as I had been when I won the America in 76. As a matter of fact, there was a tremendous post-contest depression that set in almost immediately after my name was announced. I won, but I can be much better. I've always felt somewhat of a depression after a contest because the most exciting thing for me is the preparation, and winning is always somewhat of an anticlimax.
This time it was such a severe depression that I almost started crying after the contest, not from joy, but from the depression. Readers will perhaps recall that Mike supposedly slept very little, only about an hour per night before his Mr. America win. I asked him about this and how his sleeping went prior to the universe. It's true that I wasn't sleeping before the America, and it was not a drug-induced insomnia because I was on no thyroid and no speed. I was just in such a state of psych and determination and so preoccupied with winning that contest that I'd lie awake at night visualizing how that show would turn out. In some ways, I feel that the way the America and now the universe turned out are largely due to the fact that I could visualize so strongly in my mind the actual outcome of my emergence as the winner. This year, I was not as preoccupied, just as I was not as exalted upon winning it. I wasn't getting much sleep, and I was in a state of ketosis 24 hours a day, so I was constantly hyperactive. I would go to bed about midnight. I'd get up at 4:30, do my reading, train, and then spend the rest of my day sunning and tending to my business affairs. Mike was reading the philosopher Nietzsche at almost every opportunity during his preparation period for the universe. I don't know how readers will relate to this, but my training partner during my universe workouts, and this is meant somewhat facetiously, was Nietzsche. I was reading his works for 4 to 5 hours a day before Acapulco. Reading him puts me in a certain state of mind and being. He intensifies my state of being. He's a very intense writer of a very intense philosophy. I was particularly reading his The Will to Power, and just reading it made me feel more powerful. He talks a lot in there about building a strong will and about accomplishment through determination and willpower. Reading him was great for psyching me up. The post-contest depression I mentioned is probably due in a large degree to a slowing of the high state of existence I was in while preparing for the universe. And after the super intensity of training, dieting, and mental preparation, it was a letdown to be back to normal. Although Mensur was in his lifetime best condition at the Mr. Universe contest, he was unsatisfied with the way he looked on stage. In assessing my condition there, we're talking about primarily about definition, since I was extremely happy with the size increases in my back and chest. I was, however, disappointed with my muscularity at the actual show. I pulled a Robbie Robinson, if I can use it that way, and I lost my best cuts. The day before the competition, Artie Zeller and CBS Television did considerable photography of me, and the photos will show that I was extremely ripped that day. Frank Zane, who was there as a commentator for CBS, even commented that he couldn't believe how ripped up my back was just walking on the beach a day before competing. On the day of the show, however, I was so pissed off at myself because I had gotten puffed up and the deeply etched furrows that I had had a day before just weren't there. There are two primary reasons for this, and you can count on me not making the same mistakes before the Olympia. I had upped my drug intake more than usual, which can cause water retention. That, on top of overdosing with carbs the last 2 days, probably caused it. The first day of carving up wasn't too bad because I was burning a lot of it. But the second day, I went over a threshold point, and after the muscles were saturated with the water the carbs retained, I began to bloat in the underlying skin tissue. For each gram of carbohydrates you eat, you can hold 3 grams of water. So I will need to eat a little less to keep the water only in my muscle tissues. Getting the 300 points and winning by 30 over Wilkosch of Germany leaves me with mixed emotions. It's almost embarrassing to me on one hand and an honor on the other. I personally didn't think I was that much ahead of Wilkosch, who was very ripped. If I had been as cut as the day before the show, I'd have been more comfortable in accepting that 300. Actually, nobody deserves 300 since everyone has a flaw here and there. Mike's diet for the universe was quite strict. I started dieting a month in advance because I was in pretty good shape, and then compared to what I had been prior to previous contests. Reflecting on it now, I probably could have used another week, but I still came close to what I wanted. There are one or two areas on my body which contain fatty deposits I've never been able to totally get rid of, and I think the secret to reaching the kind of cuts Zane gets would be to get rid of these final fatty accumulations. That's what I'll gear myself towards this year. Although most people probably wouldn't notice these fatty areas, I'm painfully aware of them. I'll use them as a final indices after that I have reached the peak I'm after. For the month of dieting, I was consuming no more than 500 calories per day, consisting of a protein drink in the morning with some fruit and a little chicken during the day. I had no trouble at all with energy levels, and nobody should when dieting if they keep their electrolyte balance maintained through mineral and water intake at a certain level. you have a constant source of readily available energy in the body fat being broken down. There's a tendency to throw yourself into an electrolyte imbalance on a tight diet, but by compensating with food supplements, you should have an abundance of energy. I would take large quantities of potassium tablets at any time during the day that I thought about it. If I would feel the slightest bit fatigued or run down, I'd pop 3 to 5 potassium. Before I discovered the importance of potassium, I'd diet like I do now, and I'd become so fatigued that I wouldn't be able to get out of a chair. It was almost like being paralyzed. Now the potassium increases my energy in only a few minutes. Mensur's heavy-duty training has been analyzed frequently in Muscle Builder, so I questioned him primarily about variations that he had made on what had been published about his workouts. Actually, I seldom do anything different than what I write about in Muscle Builder. For Acapulco, I train 4 days a week, working out by myself, and my workouts lasted only about 30 to 45 minutes. I did back, legs, and abs on one day, with chest, delts, and arms the next. I always tried to increase my intensity, so that last workout on the Thursday before the contest was the hardest and best that I had in preparing for the universe. I gradually increased the speed of my workouts until I was going through each one almost nonstop. When you train hard, you're not just lifting weights. You're lifting a specific amount of weight over a certain distance in a specific amount of time. One of the functions of intensity is speed. And when peaking, you have to make a concerted effort to increase the training speed. My poundage has also gradually went up until I was very, very strong. In the past, I've squatted 505 for 15 reps. And on most of the Nautilus machines, I was using the entire stack of weights. On the leg extension machine, I got up to using the whole stack plus 150 pounds of plates. With little rest between exercises, this type of weight becomes even heavier than it seems. My back workout was typical of what I did for the entire body. I would do predominantly Nautilus with maybe a barbell workout every week or two at Gold's. The Nautilus pullover and pull down were the heart of my workout, along with the behind the neck and rowing machines. I do a maximum of 6 sets, usually less. And within each set, I did positive reps to failure, forced reps, and finally negatives. On each exercise, I would use a weight that would allow me a maximum of 6 good positive reps. When I reach failure on the positives, I'd do 2 or 3 forced reps and then 2 or 3 negatives. All told, I was doing up to 12 reps per set. With this type of training, the pain and the burn in the muscle becomes increasingly intense with each repetition, and the energy drain is incredible. The pain is something you build up to and adapt to over a period of months and even years. As your ability to generate intensity increases, your ability to generate pain also increases. The average individual wouldn't be able to generate that much intensity or feel that much pain. Your ability to tolerate pain also increases, but I'm not sure the average person could bear the pain if he could generate it. In addition to the Nautilus workouts, I also did some aerobic exercise each day to burn off more calories. Bodybuilding itself burns up very little energy except when you're working your legs, so I bicycle at an aerobic pace for about 30 minutes each day. This coming year, and I've never had such a strong feeling about this before, I know that I'll be experiencing the greatest degree of improvement in my life, including my first year of training. I'm on a totally new methodology in my training, and with my greater desire to win as a professional, I know this year will be my greatest period of improvement. My first professional show will be the April 7th Night of the Champions in Pittsburgh. The February 3rd show is too soon after the universe for me. I want to be off the drugs for several months, and I just need a little break in my training intensity and severity of the diet. I can't maintain a high degree of muscularity too long without becoming a nervous wreck. I hope to compete 4 or 5 times this year. My strategy is foremost to keep my weight under control throughout the winter. Last year, I had let it get too far out of hand, and I needed 6 months to get into half-decent shape, even more to zero in for the competition. This year, I'm planning to stay in good shape without getting too heavy, and then zero in a month before each contest. Between shows, I'll drop back to 85 or 90% of my best contest condition, zeroing in with a month's intensive diet and training. In other words, I'll be fluctuating between 85 and 100% all year without staying in 100% for more than a week or so. The way my thinking is going now, I'll compete at most for 3 more years. Then it'll be time to move on to other things, which will probably mean going back to school. I'd like to get into medical school or perhaps work towards a doctorate in exercise physiology. Wow, that was interesting. 500 calories. That's unbelievable. And he would only diet for a month. And he said you should have plenty of energy just from your body fat being burned. That's pretty interesting. And he had one protein drink a day and some chicken. So his macros, I mean, he had like no carbs, no fat, and probably not even enough protein. So that's unbelievable. He was still so big. And he was still so strong in his workouts. That's crazy. And then he said the following year, he actually did do the February 3rd show, which was the Southern Professional Cup. And he won that show. So he won his first professional show, which was in Miami in 1979. And he beat Robbie. And then he did do the Pittsburgh show, I believe. And I can't remember where. I think he took third in that contest. And then he did the Night of the Champions, which Robbie won again. And Danny Padilla was second. And that was the year Danny got a 300 score. And then he lost the pose down to Robbie. And then Mike was third in that contest. And then I believe what happened in 1979 was his mother passed away and he was very depressed. And then I think he got out of shape and he was going to just blow off the Olympia. And I believe his brother Ray talked him into it and got him psyched up again. And then he trained like an animal for the Olympia and he took second place in his first Olympia and he almost won the overall. He almost beat Frank Zane. So that's a pretty crazy year. He wins his first pro show. Drops down a little bit from the Night of the Champions, loses his mother, gets out of shape, and then comes in incredible shape for the Olympia. I remember reading that article about his crazy year in 1979. And then it's interesting at the end there, he says, I think I'm only going to compete 3 more years. And he actually competed 2 more years. And then after 1980. And then Danny Padilla told me that when he talked to Mike, Mike said he was only going to do the Olympia like a couple times. And if he didn't win, then he was going to quit. So he stuck to that. All right. So that's it for this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed it. We will hopefully be back next week with another interview, or maybe I'll just read some old articles as I've been doing. Also check out my Muscle Maturity podcast, which now is on YouTube. And that's with Old School Labs, the one I do with Samir Banu. We had an interesting discussion this week about posing in bodybuilding. So you guys want to check that out too. That should be up on YouTube by the time you hear this podcast. All right, guys, have a great week. Train hard, and we will see you guys next week. Take care.